Our friend writer Colin Fleming, whose newest book is terrific. It's called If You Brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, Hope. Colin joins us. Hello there, Mr. Fleming.
How's it going, Kimball?
I'm doing pretty well, thank you. I like it when you called me Richard last week. I thought I was back in school.
Yeah, I like to just keep it fresh. You know how it is.
I understand.
You don't want to just always be repeating yourself on these radio and podcast things. So I figured, but you know what? I felt schoolmarmish, and I didn't want to be like some guy who was disciplining you from the lower portion of New England. So I've ditched it this week.
All right. Well, that's good. But you got to keep it new and different every week. So this week we're going to talk about the first four stories in this wonderful collection, starting with Brackets, that sort of sets the tone for the book. And I love it as an inveterate note taker. I liked it a lot in the way it's structured, but also it's what's not there. It's what's unsaid. It's what's between the brackets that often counts in the story and in life.
It sets the tone, I think, in that this is going to be a very different kind of story collection. And so it starts with a very different kind of story. And I think it's kind of a bravura type of move, starting a book, which is really how I think of it. It's just how we talk about a book that's comprised of various pieces of as being an essay collection or a story collection or whatever might be relevant. But I always think of them as books. So I don't really break them down that way in a sense, but you have to conversationally. So I think with this story, I wanted to have something where it's like, whoa, I can't believe a book begins with a story that takes the form of, it's sort of a hybrid. It's a grocery list and a grocery list that morphs into notes to self. And I've never seen a story like that. It functions as narrative, but it also functions as sculpture. And I think you're right. We have these stories that we tell, and a lot of times those are going to be told by what we leave out, which is going to emphasize the specific parts that we put in. So if you were to find, it could be anyone's grocery list for the day. It could be something they scribbled down the night before about what they were going to do. That's interesting reading in and of itself. It's almost like eavesdropping in on a life, even in a way that like a first-person story isn't quite, because the person telling us the first-person story is meaning to. This isn't really meaning to. It's like a found text, but think of anyone you know in life, student or someone at a shop you go to who works there. If you found her notes to self, her grocery list, it would give you information about that person. And it wouldn't just give you information about that person. It would give you, in some ways, insight into their inner workings. But this is going to detail the inner workings of a significant passage in life, the end of a relationship.
And it sort of creates a through line for the book, which is missed communications, the things that are both said and unsaid that can either sustain or destroy relationships.
Or the things that might not have happened that someone imagines, because the narrator as such of this opening work is an unreliable narrator, because it's someone, a guy who's caught up in the heat of the moment. And you think about why we write lists for ourselves. It's to organize our thoughts, right? Our brain, what we're going to do this weekend, how our morning's going to go tomorrow with a fresh start for work. You're trying to get control on something that you don't want to spiral away from you. And it's like the same way when sometimes we'll write in a journal or we'll write a letter that we're never going to mail. And the reason we're doing that is to get something out of our system, although we might not be thinking of it that way at the time, and also to marshal our thoughts, to hopefully get rid of the fog and have clarity. And he's working himself up. It's a very funny story, too, because there's like this other, it's like a love triangle, and it becomes very sort of graphic in his imagination, because it's just our nature to assume the worst, especially in a situation like that, and it's getting quite visual. But if you didn't understand English, too, and you just, like, nailed this to the wall, it functions as something that's architectonic. It has not just a rhythm and a flow to it, but the way it's rendered, it's not just words. Words are struck through, things are underlined,
there's shorthand, like the plus sign or things of that nature. It looks like a text that we're going to decode the same way we would decode someone's list. Like, oh, yeah, so that's the kind of beer he gets. It gives you, like, it doesn't seem like a lot in that example, but it is something. It's something that we use to build on to something else. So you get this whole story here, this word painting at the same time. So if I came to a book like this and a book opened like that, I'd think, like, you have to be kidding me. Who starts a book like this? And then it's going to become quite a bit different.
And it tells us a lot about the narrator. A couple of things that stood out to me. One is what he chooses to do with the vermin that he catches in traps in his apartment, and also the Gene Tierney reference.
Yes. So he's someone who is well-cultured, I would say. But he's coming undone. And in a sense, he's falling back on these defense mechanisms to comfort himself. And they might not reflect so well upon him, but he's almost thinking, plebeian, who's this guy? And he's showing off his education in a way, but not in a way that leaves the rest of us out, because we've all been there. It's tough not to have been there, no matter how intent you were or might have been or tried to live a sheltered life. So he's piecing this together, and at the same time, he's trying to, again, we've all been there. It's like, fine, never again will I have anything to do with you sort of vibe. But he's also bargaining against himself because he's scheming how he might get her back with these gestures that would appeal specifically to her and only to her of all the people in the world, because there were these private things that they shared that he thought undergirded their relationship. So it's heartbreaking. It's funny. He has these, he's not living in, like, wealth and style. He's talking about rapscallions, and he's sort of befriending these, like, vermin that he kills and everything as it's going on in his life. And it's all just a form of a very believable, because he tells you, it's like, oh, get some pesto. Like, it's right in his shopping list. And maybe we get the sense that his shopping list is something that's going to cook something for her, to win her back, and it becomes this giant cluster, this sculptural cluster. And so, really, it bridges all these worlds between writing and visual art and sonic artistry. And I think that's a good way to start the book, because it's going to be a book that ranges quite far. And so you have this shortest story in the book, and it itself is ranging far, even in terms of, like, its various forms.
Colin Fleming with his son, Dantan. The second chapter of the book is called Blinkered, and it... we join the story in the midst of a pretty heated argument between a couple with a narrator this time around who's trying his best to calm the situation if he can, because, well, the neighbors are listening.
Blinkered is a different version, and I've only done this with this story, of a story called Crab Apples that is in between Cloud and Horizon. And it was sort of my Strawberry Fields Forever, where you listen to the first take of Strawberry Fields Forever, and then you listen to either the finished version, which is a composite of a slower and a faster version, or some of the just faster, heavier versions. This was sufficiently different. It starts in the middle of things in medias res, and it's a bit afield from Crab Apples that way. I'd say Crab Apples is more of a traditional story in terms of its arc, the beginning, the middle, and the end. This is pure power stroke. This is pure energy, but energy with mental plotting, because this is a scene of a story of domestic discord at best, and domestic abuse, physical abuse at worst. And you have a woman who is mentally troubled, unstable, and you have a guy who has done some bad things to try to rein that in. And they are physically engaged, where they even struggle and fall to the floor. And he's talking about another time when she bit out the webbing between his thumb and his forefinger. And he's just trying to quiet her. But ironically, at the same time as he's trying to quiet her, he's abusing her. So it becomes, again, this notion of a cluster. And especially now in our age, we have all of these examples. People should know this anyway. But if you didn't know it anyway, it's there every single day in the news to remind us of this couple that looks so sweet and cuddly and smiley on Instagram. And we can all think of famous and not so famous examples from our own life. And then behind the scenes, there's all this stuff going on. So she wants him to atone and to be contrite and to write down on a piece of paper what he's done and sort of own up to his past transgressions. She takes this piece of paper after he does this, trying to save the relationship, and she goes down into the building he lives in, and like she tapes it down there for everyone who lives there to see. And it becomes, again, just this, it's not a long story, but in terms of the rhythm and the energy, I mean, it's a very energy story in terms of that, the prose. It's all like, again, musical, but this time, like, the music is not as, it doesn't have the same beats as the first story. There's more flow to it, but it's a manic kind of rhythm.
And there's a really powerful moment in the story when our narrator says, I used to believe in the lulls, that a lull would become something lasting. Wow.
He's talking about, well, you can blow that up large, like bouncy house style, and talk about life. I mean, life really is a series of beginnings over. And what he's talking about specifically in the context of the story is that she would have these interludes of calmness and of peace when they would seem to be going along fine, and what passed for their relationship, the simulacrum of health and stability. And he knows that those lulls are not going to last. It's almost like he's timing them, like with this emotional stopwatch, but he doesn't know when the actual whistle is going to blow, signaling that that's the end of this particular game. Now we're starting a different game. And so when you lose faith in those lulls as something that can be prolonged, even if they can't be prolonged, I think it's important to have this faith that they could be if we work harder and try better and love harder and take better care of ourselves and the people around us. But that's just not the nature of life, no matter how well-intentioned or solid your character is. And so it's sobering. It's real. You get the sense that these are young people. They're not like 57. And he's coming upon all of these epiphanies that are imbuing him with a certain wisdom, but it's a tragic, sad, bitter, hurtful sort of wisdom at the same time.
And it's such a universal story because so many of us have been there. We've all been there, I think, in situations where you know it's not going to work out well, but you tell yourself that it can work out. It will get better if we can just do the right thing, even if you're not sure what that might be.
Or there's a sort of narcissism to it as well, which it's sort of faux narcissism, because you think it's like Bill Belichick. It's like, if I get this guy in my system, I can coach him up and he can do things here that he couldn't do when he was on the Dolphins, and he'll work well for us and go out and catch 100 balls and Wes Welker and all that stuff. That's how we are inclined to live our lives. And it's not our instinctual inclination, because that's the tricky thing with humans. We don't have instincts because we have this thing called free will. But our innate humanness, that sort of human nature, is what drives us to think. And it's sometimes one of the most beautiful things you can do for someone, and you can do for yourself, is to say goodbye. Mm. And we always talk about the power of a first impression and a hello. But there's grace in a goodbye, and there's gratitude, and there's power, and there's self-preservation, and there's a new lease on life and a chance for a person, for two people, however many people it might be, two in this case. But he's not getting there, or at least he's not there when we leave him at the end of the story. But I think that later on, hopefully, like, the cops don't come and all these other things don't go screwy in everyone's life and she doesn't get hurt further, but that's kind of where we leave him. So it's like, boom, one story, boom, two stories, and they're completely stylistically unrelated, but thematically we're covering some of the same ideas just from different angles.
The third chapter, the third story in the book is Yellow Hammers. God, that story just absolutely blew me away. It was so great. And it involves, a family with a young man, his little sister, and a friend who's a jazz musician who needs a little help. And along the way, we get this just wonderful story about friendship, growing up, being on the cusp of adulthood, but hanging on to the innocence of youth. And it's just so rich and so funny and so poignant.
This is a long story. So the way story collections are supposed to work is, well, I'll let the readers, the listeners in on a little secret. People tell you the way story collections are supposed to work is that all the stories are of a stylistic piece. They're similar. But that's not the reason that story collections read as they do. No one actually intends for them to come out that way. They come out that way because the writer is limited, and the writer can only write in one style, in one voice, one medium. So they're going to do their things, and then they're going to stick those stories together simply because they were by that person, and they're going to get very samey very quickly, and you're probably going to be bored. So I think the way this book is billed on Amazon is it breaks the cardinal rule of story collection. Well, it does and it doesn't. I'm just simply able to do that. And if other people could do it too, well, of course they would. Why would you want the same story over and over again in a book? So this one I think of as Yellowhammers refers to, if people don't know the sporting term, it's the name for the old school, you still hear it, but old school name for a curveball in baseball, because the young men in this story are successful, talented little leaguers. But I think of this story as, so we've done kind of like the avant-garde sculptural story. We've done the manic energy blast of prose story. This, to me, is young adult fiction for adults. I don't want to say like it's pretty Saturday Evening Post back in the day, but this is the warm afghan you wrap yourself in, and it's a big, rich, luxurious story. But again, that idea of young adult fiction, but for adults, for Kimballs. And this this young African-American boy, his father's going through things, and he comes to stay up north with this white family. And the reason he does that is because the narrator's father, the white dad, is a jazz scholar, and he's heralded the works of this underappreciated, well, he thinks he's a genius. And he comes to stay, and the boy's asthmatic, and he ends up kind of like blowing up the boy's turf, like his life, his clout, even though he's a good kid and they're friends. And the young man who's the protagonist, the white kid in the story, he does something that is, it has lethal implications. And also it's a story where you have an airplane dropping an orange out of the sky and kids trying to catch it on a little league field. It's like a promotion. So,
which is just the greatest idea of a small town tradition that I can recall reading, that you would put these 11-year-olds out there and say, yeah, just catch this orange plummeting to earth at about 130 miles an hour.
So, I mean, it's just, yeah, right. And the kid does get brained, and he ends up like in the hospital over it. But he's, like I said, he's done something quite bad. Like, it's not like, well, he takes some blade to someone, but the potential results of this choice he's made could end a life. And the two young men, I think they're young men for different reasons. The African-American kid is a young man before his time because of his family situation and certain things he's gone through, and also the idea that he's raised by this brilliant father. And then the protagonist of the story is becoming a young man by the end because he's exhibited this real growth. But they have to work it out between themselves. And so it's a sports story, but you don't have to be a sports person at all to sort of dial in on the drama of this at-bat that the protagonist is going to have. Because this young man from the South, he's an awesome, awesome pitcher. And it's like this fait accompli that something is going to happen. Sometimes in life, something is going to happen and it's bad. And it's up to you to do the right thing and just take it. To use like another sports analogy, it's like when the guy in the breakout gets a bad pass and it's an escape in his defensive end in hockey. What do you want to do? You just want to get rid of that puck as quickly as possible and make the trouble go away. But you have to eat it. You have to just put it in your skates, get ready to brace your body for the hit, and maybe tie it up for a face-off and play for the next shift, but you have to eat it. And so in a different, in a baseball sense, the protagonist of the story, he eats it.
And there's a great moment in the story, too. And I think this applies certainly to young men and probably young women playing sports, but it applies in many areas of life and growing up. But you write, sometimes there's such a gap between you and someone else in one area that is relevant, maybe even super important to both your lives, that you're not all that threatened. They're just better. But you're also not threatened because you figure you'll make up that distance somewhere else. And we've all done that. Well, that's all right. I know I'm better at this other thing, even though it's not as important to me.
There's a woman. She's a failed writer. Her name is Carolyn Kubler. She's editor of the New England Review, just meaningless literary journal. Seven people read it. She saw this story, and to speak to your point from the bit of the text you just read, she saw this story in another story later on in the book called One Way Zebra, and she'll never do anything of significance with her writing. She'll never publish anywhere significant, and more importantly than that, she'll never write anything of equality that one could have a conversation about, like we're having a conversation about this. And she said to me, they're just not any good. This Yellowhammers is just not any good. Now, that's not, it's not a story that's like up for a subjective debate. I mean, things are things. And I knew what it was. And I also knew why she was saying that, because she wasn't secure enough in herself. She was threatened by what I was able to do and things that she'd never be able to do. And so that's often what happens with me. I come along with like this great work to someone who can't do it. And I'm just setting myself up to have them say whatever they want to say, because that's their moment. That's their moment of power. But the kid in this story, he's not entirely that way. It's like if you were on the Bulls in 1995 and you were Steve Kerr, you shouldn't be threatened by Michael Jordan. He's Michael Jordan. There's a place for you to get on the wing, be ready for the pass, knock down the three. That's what you're there for. You're not there to be Michael Jordan, but maybe you, I don't know, you're this fantastic father and you're focused on your family life. And Jordan isn't. You've made it up elsewhere, maybe in an area that's not quite as like glamorous the way we think of it, but that's what the kid is thinking about here. So he's really coming into that notion of being this young man, because that's the way that an adult thinks who has accrued some wisdom in life. And wisdom is often experiential. So we've seen the experiential aspect, and now we're witnessing his own realization of where he's not a kid anymore. He is, but he isn't.
Fourth story we want to talk about is titled My Death Tie, and it begins with a death, a funeral, the great aunt of the narrator, and it goes from there to an interesting friendship. Well, I guess it's a friendship. We have all had those people, the Judds in our lives, that are not very good people, but there's something that binds us together.
There is, and you have like that other friend who steps in, and they're like, why are you friends with that guy? Like, they almost have, like, an intervention. We've all had that, right? And then you're on the spot because you can't, the other friend will say, like, it's a bad person. You can't be like, nah, they're really great. You just don't know them because you both know them. And they're this sort of, like, shady friend is that person that, like, when you're a kid, your parents pull you aside and tell you to stay away from people like that. Stops coming over the house, like the kid version of that. So this is a young man in this story. And he has this tie, this pre-tied, because he doesn't know how to tie a tie. And if he's wearing this tie, it means that somebody has died. It's his death tie. It's the only thing he brings it out for. And so he's engaged, and he thinks life is going okay, and he has this great aunt who dies, and there's this shady character, this like frenemy, whatever you want to call it, named Judd. And Judd is the type of guy who, like, he meets not the great aunt who's dead, but he meets the narrator's, like, his regular aunt. So she's like whatever she is, like in her 40s, early 50s. And he's the type of guy who has no compunction saying, like, dude, hook me up with your aunt. And the narrator says, she's married to my uncle. Which really, like, is as basic a retort as you can have. Like, he's so taken aback. He's, like, he's scaled it to that level of, like, how did you know he was dead. Well, he wasn't alive anymore. Like, he's gone like that basic. And Judd's response is, I'm cool with that. Almost like, what the hell is, like, there's going to be like a cuckolding situation going on or something. And ha ha ha. Like early sort of like shades of meatheads. But he's just like a dirty dog like that. Someone you don't want around, but they're friends. And so the narrator comes to find out that, like, his fiance is kind of like into this guy too. So he's having this whole crisis over this funeral and the great aunt and how her life ended up. And it's a very funny story, but it just also goes to show how our lives or what we think we know, the rug we believe is like stapled to the floor beneath us, is just ready to go, like flying carpet style. And then he really sort of has a panic attack.
And like that Judd goes to bars at closing time and picks up the vulnerable women and then does unspeakable things to them in the alley, to which the narrator's fiance says, that's messed up. He must be really handsome.
I feel like I can share this without spoiling it because there's so much more in the story. And so what happens is the bar is closed at whatever, 2:00. So Judd is the type of guy who showers at like 1:15 in the morning and home and goes out the streets of the city, like on the prowl for like women, like bent over a throat, like, you need a ride home, like that type of thing, because he's that kind of guy. So there's this alley next to a bakery he goes to, and he's in there with a woman, and they're doing their thing, and she's in this sort of canine type of situation she's in, and the cars are going by on the street, and he starts chanting, look at the lights, look at the lights! And he reprises this later when, like, there are these construction workers outside, and so look at the lights becomes, tell them to work harder. Tell them to work harder. And he's that. Now everyone hearing this is thinking, you're thinking about someone in your life that you knew at whatever point this was. And it can be like in your 20s. I mean, hell, if you live in the North End, it can be like in your 50s or 60s. It can be like when you were in junior high or like that player on the football team in high school or whatever. But it becomes this crisis of the soul for this young man who now doesn't even know if his marriage is going to work out, because when he shares some of this information to his young female friend, she seems to get a kick out of it. And just like the great aunt, who all of a sudden, like, she was alive and was going along fine, and she was dead, apple cart overturned, this living man, young man, is having his apple carts overturned in a story that's, again, very different from the three that we've already seen, which were so different from each other.
Circle of life, man. Circle of life.
Yeah, that's what he says, because it's one of those stories that's great. You can quote it, it's funny, but like when you read it and you see how it all comes together, because it just looks like it's going to be like some sort of like harmless fun, like a riff on like that Tool that we all knew. But it hits hard. Like when he's talking about, like, he's so freaked out at one point, he's worried about being interred in the earth. And in a panic, he's like, I want to be cremated. And he turns to the fiance. It's like, just remember my wishes. I'll be ashes. Do a shot of me. Keep me around. What the hell is wrong with you? And he's just melting down.
Well, it's the first of four stories that we'll talk about more in this great new book from Colin Fleming, If You, brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, Hope. It's available everywhere. Get your hands on it. And as always, a phenomenal read that's going to make you think about life and yourself and the big picture and the little things that make up a life as well. Colin, appreciate it. As always, let's do it again next Tuesday.
Okay, thanks, sir.
Colin Fleming on Dan Tetzel.